Matthew 21, verse 23 is where we are. Mike covered the fig tree withering. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that filling in. I have to commend Mike. I haven't got to hear the message yet, but I do know this. Mike is courageous enough to take whatever's next and run with it. And that's not easy, especially when it's a very challenging passage like the withering of the fig tree. So kudos to you, Mike. Extra credit for you. As always, thanks for making your way out from the very dark fall that we're in and making your way to church here. We sang the prayer of our hearts that we want to see the Lord, and the way that the Spirit has chosen to answer that oftentimes in my own life is by directing us to the Gospels, that we get to see Jesus in action and understand a little bit more of who He is and what kind of discipleship He invites us to, particularly if we're leaders. And that's what's interesting about the next few stories. They're all directed at leaders. So in some ways, I'm preaching to myself, but everyone has some role of leadership in their life. Everyone has people that they're responsible for, things that they are in charge of, or things that they have some sense of ownership of. And in that regard, there's a call for all of us to learn as Jesus challenges the leaders of His day. And it doesn't get more challenging than someone popping into your domain and taking charge and taking over. And that's, of course, exactly what's happened in our story before us, Matthew 21, 23. If you're there, the first words show us the scene. Jesus entered the temple courts, and while He was teaching. So He's taken over the temple. This small town Galilean comes in to the big city capital of Jerusalem, walks into its holiest shrine, its national symbol, where the chief priests are the ones who have authority, and He starts taking over. He makes Himself at home as if it's His temple, and as if He has the authority to just start teaching in the midst of it if He would like. The question, of course, the chief priests are going to ask is, who does this guy think he is? You know, we're in charge. He's not in charge. And that, of course, is the question that's going to arise in our story tonight, that the authorities, the chief priest, the elders, the wealthy people that have elite power in the temple are going to ask of Jesus, what makes you think you have any authority to do what you're doing? And the reason they're doing this is not because they want to learn anything about Jesus. Jesus is a threat to them, because He's come in and He's taken over. And from this point on, and actually it began right at the head of chapter 21 after the triumphal entry, all of the gospel is conflict. But the difference between this conflict and previous conflict is now Jesus intentionally is engaging in conflict. He is making Himself the focus of conflict. Where before, if you paid attention, Matthew will have Jesus withdrawing, Jesus withdrew, because it's not time to get into conflict. But now He's going to immerse Himself in it, and we're going to find as we encounter Jesus in all these controversies and conflicts that He's the master of it, that no one will ever best Him. And the way He goes about besting them is helpful for us as we wrestle with how we make our way in this world and how we lead in a way that is patterned after the way of Jesus. And so we have Jesus, He's making Himself at home in the temple, and we have a different set of interlocutors, people who are taking Him on. So verse 23 again, He enters the temple courts while He was teaching. The chief priest, we've seen them before, they're the ones with the most authority, they're the top. And the elders of the people came to Him. This is the first time the elders have got involved. Elders are the wealthy elite. They're the aristocracy. They're the ones who have the money. And the ones who have the money are usually in league with the people at top. And that's what's going on here. The chief priest and the people with the most money, the wealthy elite, have banded together, as they usually do when you're talking about power, and they have a question to ask of Jesus, and that question is found in verse 23. By what authority are you doing these things? They asked. And who gave you this authority? The reason they can do this is Jesus is not a chief priest. He's not a scribe. He's had no education. He is not an elder. He's not anyone that should have any role of authority at this particular time and place. And so they're, quite honestly, but yet in a way to trip Him up, as we'll see before we're done, are saying, you don't have any right to do this. What gives you the right? Who gave you this authority? Now, we, the readers, and Matthew knows we've been reading this or having it read to us the way the ancient world would receive it. He knows that we've already read this gospel up to this point, and we know that Jesus teaches as one who has authority. And he's not like the teachers of the law. He actually seems to have this air of authority about him in the way he presents things. That's the very last line at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. He had authority, and people sense that. But we've also been told by Jesus and from his lips himself, all things have been handed over to me by my Father. So that his source of authority is God the Father. That God has divinely commissioned him to the end that he is heading toward, and that is to be proclaimed as and affirmed as Israel's Messiah. So we have that information. The priests obviously don't. All they see is someone with no formal training, someone without priestly credentials. And in their mind, the only person that would legitimately have a right to top their authority, the authority of the chief priest, is Messiah himself. If the Messiah were to come, that's the only one that could possibly topple their authority or be above them. But of course, they're not ready to admit that Jesus is Messiah. And so there's a sense of a trickery behind that question you find at the end of verse 23. Just like before, they're trying to trap Jesus. They've got a loaded question. They want to make him look bad. So when they ask by what authority, they're not curiously and honestly looking for information. They don't want to think through what he has to say and say, oh, well, maybe you're right. They are instead looking for an opportunity to condemn him. They want to see this guy out of the picture. He's got the crowds behind him. He's got the people listening to his teaching. They'd like to, in some way, trip him up so that he's no longer in their temple. And so Jesus knows there's a trick behind this. And so he replies in verse 24, okay, I'll ask you one question, and if you answer me, I'll tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. I love that. You know, I'm not going to answer your question, but let's play a game. And the game is this: if you'll answer one question, that's all, just answer this one question, then I'll sincerely, honestly answer your question. So that's what he's set up. What he's done effectively is put them in the spotlight. He's put them on the hot seat. They're trying to put Jesus on the hot seat. And by simply saying this, now it's Jesus is putting them on the hot seat because he wants to see how they'll answer this particular question he's about to give them. Because if they answer this correctly, then they'd really have the answer to their first question. So the question he asked them, verse 25, John's baptism, where did it come from? Was it from heaven, that means from God, or from men? That's the question. It's as simple as that. John, that's John the Baptist, the one who'd been beheaded by King Herod, the forerunner, the Messiah, the one who had said, after me is coming one greater than me, mightier than me. He is the Messiah. John the Baptist, who saw that in Jesus. So that John's mission and Jesus' mission are intertwined. John has been the forerunner. Jesus is now the proclaimed Messiah. So he says, you know, John, was his baptism, what he did, was it divinely commissioned? Did God give that commission to John? Or is he just popular because he's a great speaker and people kind of were interested in him and he grabbed the crowd's fancy for a bit, but really what he has to say isn't worth listening to? And that's where I love how the crowd, or these group of people, the chief priest and the elders, how they come up with their solution. The answer to the question, which you'll see before we're done, is no answer at all, really. But the way they answer this is they kind of back away, I envision it. They huddle together and they start discussing among themselves. You know, we got to answer this question. And we read in this, they discussed it among themselves and they said, hey, listen, if we say that John's baptism was from heaven, then Jesus will ask us, why didn't you believe John? But if we say John's baptism was just of human origin from men, we're afraid of the people, for they all hold that John was a prophet. So they understand what's at stake. They say, you know, if we say that John was divinely ordained and John pointed to you, then we're admitting that John's message that you're the Messiah is one we need to listen to and we need to follow. But we don't want to do that. But if we say John's baptism was of human origin, he was just a great speaker and he grabbed the people's fancy for a bit, were afraid of the people. They love him. The people love John the Baptist. So what do we do? And they're left stuck because they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. They can't answer either question without giving in to either the fear of the people or their fear of having to perhaps respond to Jesus and his claim to messiahship in a positive way. So, these leaders, leaders appointed by God, leaders that have been trained and instructed in the Torah and the ways of God, determine that the way they'll answer this question is not by seeking the truth, but through political expediency. They will do like our politicians and check their approval ratings and calculate their options and think, what's the best answer? You know, we don't want to lose the approval of the crowds. We also don't want to lose face. So which answer are we going to give in order to deal with this? And we find that for these leaders, it's the winds of popular opinion that really force their hand. They're not in their religion to find truth. They're not in this game to try to discover and uncover what God's will really might be and what God really is doing. They're in this game of power. And whoever wins is the one who stays at top. And if Jesus is Messiah, they're going to lose that top, particularly because they disagree with how he's expressing that messiahship. If they say that, you know, John wasn't really a prophet, they're going to lose the approval of the people. So they're stuck. They're stuck in a trench. And so their answer is, verse 27, a very whimpering, they answer Jesus, "We don't know." Now you see what a cop-out that is. You do realize these guys are not unopinionated people. These aren't people. No leader is. No one's, you know, "I just don't know. I could care less. We They are showing their hand, and they are showing that it's not that they don't know. They don't want to have to say either of their options because both give them away as being anything but righteous leaders. Both answers show their true face. And so they won't give an indirect response. And when they won't give a direct response. And when Jesus hears that, he then says, and it's the end of verse 27, then Jesus said, "Well, you know the game. I was going to ask you one question. And if you gave me the answer, then I'd give you your answer. But I'm not going to tell you by what authority I'm doing these things." And that story's over. And we move into three parables of judgment of leaders. And we'll look at those over the coming weeks. The parable of the two sons, the tenants, and the wedding banquet. But Jesus is going to hit them hard with three parables that are intended to go right at the throats of leaders who fail to live out and to seek what God desires for God's people. So they don't respond, and many people say, well, Jesus really isn't answering their question, but I would argue the question he asks would answer their question if they could answer Jesus' question honestly. I love this little cartoon. This is Agnes Day. There are two sheep always talking, and the first sheep says, "I don't get why Jesus brings up John the Baptist." And the other sheep says, it's because their answer to his question about John is actually their answer to their question about Jesus. Because John and Jesus share the same mission, Jesus has given them an indirect answer. He's just demanding that they come to grips with what they refuse to accept. That if John's baptism, which the people accept, really is of God, then it might just so be that Jesus, whom John pointed to, is the Messiah that John was the forerunner of. And if that's the case, the authority, by what authority do you do this? The answer is God's. God's given me authority. It's God's temple, after all, and I've come to speak and teach the Word of God in the midst of God's temple. But the leaders, in their failure to answer Jesus' question, show that they don't really care much about truth. They care about holding on to the reins of power. And they also, in many ways, are making it very obvious that Jesus doesn't mind if the truth gets out, no matter what the response is. He's not concerned. He wants to just get the truth out. Well, that's our story, and what I'd like to do with this story is allow it to lead us to two reflections, because there's two big ideas coming across in this story. One is about fear, the fear of others. One is about authority and the proper use of power. The first one is about leadership and fear, and in order that I'm not just speaking to myself primarily, I actually think we can expand that to this really in some way is about God-fearers, those who have a sincere seriousness toward God in whatever direction that leads us, versus people who want the adulation and the admiration and approval of others. We all know what it's like to live in a world where we are seeking others' approval. Over this vacation last week, my wife and I watched one episode of Black Mirror. It's on Netflix if anyone's seen it. It is the British version of Twilight Zone, although since it's on Netflix, it's much more graphic and much more, in some ways, grotesque. I don't necessarily recommend it to everyone, but this episode was pretty, I'd say, tame compared to some of the other episodes. But it's season 3, episode 1, and in this episode, there's a girl in the future, and it's just sometime in the future, and every interaction that takes place between people, everyone has, like they sort of do now, an object in their hand. And it looks a lot like, you know, about 6x3. And they're holding it, and with every interaction they have, they swipe 1 through 5 stars. So I talked to Glenn, and if I thought it was a good interaction, 5 stars. If I didn't really appreciate Glenn or what he had to say, I'd give him 1 star. Or you guys all hear me speak, and you give me whatever star rating you want. But everyone does it with every interaction, and the whole society is stratified by there are those who have 4.5 stars and above, and they are like the celebrities and the gods of that culture. And you want to be in that group. And then there's the group that's about 3.5 to 4.5, and in our story, the girl, the main character, is in that category, and she desperately wants to get to that next level. And so everything she does simply to please other people. And so she puts on, as best she can, the act of, you know, smiling at everybody. And even if she doesn't like your service, she gives you 5. Or if she didn't like something you did, she gives you 5. And over the course of the story, without giving the ending away, because it's worth watching if you're interested, she realizes the cost of seeking others' approval as one's sole course in life. And it really is about that. It's about, first off, thinking that because you got a 4.5 to 5, you're really something. And we find out those people are less than deep. They're very, very superficial because all they care about is others' approval. And she also finds out that perhaps trying to be at that high level of everyone approves you is not necessarily the way to be truly authentic and real. That you have to become really phony in order to have everyone like you. And we all know that. There's a challenge that we all have because we don't want to be jerks, at least I think most of us don't. But we also don't want to be so pliable that we have no convictions and no sense of where we want to go in our lives, no sense of what's right or what's wrong. And so it's something that we wrestle with, the approval of others versus what we perceive as right and the way that we need to go forward in life. And that's just as true for anyone in a leadership position. We see these men here, the chief priest and the scribes, they have all the power. They're at the top. But they're surprisingly anxious when the children were praising in the temple a few passages earlier. Do you remember that? Shut up, these kids. That unnerves them. Just these little children praising is enough to get them very anxious. And now that people are listening to Jesus, that also causes them to think, boy, if they're loving Jesus, they're going to have less love for us. We're not going to have all the approval that we once had. So that fear of disapproval, that craving for approval, it's in us all. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing unless it becomes the only thing. And when it's the only thing, we fail to actually have any conviction and we fail to actually have any authenticity. Better to be someone with conviction who is highly tolerant and liking of others than to be someone who has no conviction and just becomes whatever the crowd wants them to be. I think this is going to be more of a challenge for the next generation and the generations to come because we're much more integrated. We see everything. We want to share everything. And what we're desperately looking for the most part, is for people to give us fives. 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 Like. 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 And, you know, that don't like, it doesn't exist on Facebook because I think Zuckerberg knows that's not going to help anybody. Well, when that comes into play in leadership, that's when all of a sudden fear can really warp how things should go forward. And that's why I thought this quote by Thomas Long was so good. Thomas said, "Leaders especially need to be motivated by truth. rather than the opinions or pressures of the crowd. We are called to witness to the truth, not to be swayed by fear of the people we seek to influence. Sensitivity to the needs and concerns of people is necessary, but fear will always paralyze and damage the best intention. So you can see the balance he's trying to strike there. That you have this clear call that you're not trying to be completely dead to what people need and concerns they have, but you don't want those to completely drive your way forward. I think when you consider what's going on here, you can just go back in Matthew and see why Jesus has the boldness to do what he does. Keep in mind, Jesus doesn't need the approval of the chief priest. He doesn't need the approval of the scribes. He doesn't need the approval of the Pharisees. Otherwise, he wouldn't have the courage to say the things he does. I don't think he's one who would be averse to having their approval. I think he wants the best for them and loves them because he loves his enemies. But he's not going to let that drive his ministry. And he's already told his own disciples in Matthew 10, "Be not afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell." And I know people have an adverse reaction to that, but this is a way of Jesus saying, take God the most seriously. God's approval, God's pleasure, God's will is what you want more than anything, because others who think they have power might have the power to kill you, and that'll happen to Christ, but they don't have supreme power. Because the truth is the power, and the truth is God's Messiah has arrived, and the truth is Christ is risen, and so forth. So that Jesus has already spoken about this. I love, when I think of people-pleasing versus God-fearing, passages that come to my mind are, for example, in 1 Thessalonians, Paul writes, "We speak as those approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We're not trying to please people, but God." Or in Galatians 1:10, where there's more of controversy going on, he says, "Am I now trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? If I were still trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Christ." That, every student in seminary that's getting into it to help people ought to let that burn into their consciousness. Because part of helping people is realizing at times you may have to say and point to things that are not very enjoyable, that are quite challenging and quite convicting. Now, this doesn't mean you're to be a jerk, because the same Paul who wrote these things, that I'm not trying to please people but God, in 1 Corinthians 10 says, "Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God, even as I try to please everyone in every way, for I'm not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved." This is why you got to take the whole counsel of Scripture. Paul is more than willing to say, "I'm willing to do whatever I need to for the sake of the truth, even if others don't approve of it. But as I go about my way, living the gospel life, the way of Jesus, my goal is to bring all to salvation. And part of that is me doing everything I can to be kind and empathetic and compassionate and loving and listening and open and tolerant and so forth." So you get that balance a little bit. I find it to be one of the great challenges. I think one of the great, great challenges of, and all of us faced it, going through the teenage years, is the approval of peers takes on an importance that is some of us forget. It's like multiplied by infinity. It weighs so heavy. And it's not easy to bear, because we're trying to figure out who we ourselves are anyway. The older we get, many of us are able to get to the point, the older and older you get, "I don't care what people think, I'm going to do what I like." Some to the point where they are jerky and old, you know, crumps. "I'll say what I want, who cares what these kids think." That's not good either, that's not that. So we get older and we realize everyone's not thinking about us all the time. In fact, most people aren't thinking about us most of the time. I'm the one thinking mostly about how others perceive me, and I've got to learn how to not let that drive the course of my life, because if I'm seeking the approval of others more than the approval of God, I'm showing who my God is. I'm showing that. And that's what's happening for the chief priest. That's what's happening for the elders in our story. So that's one of my reflections on fearing God versus people-pleasing. But there's another issue involved in this text, and it has to do with authority and that delicate balance of power. One of the great challenges of postmodern philosophy is it has reduced every social interaction to an issue of power. So that we read ancient documents and we say, well, the reason they're written is, you know, the Gospels are written because the church had the power and they had the power to write whatever documents they did and to take the heretics out however they wanted, as if everything's about this push of power. And power is almost universally perceived as a bad thing. I would argue that that's an overreaction. There is some truth in it, but power's neither good nor bad. Power is something that one has to be very, very careful with because it is a great responsibility. You know, Spider-Man had it right. Uncle Ben. With great power comes great responsibility. And then there are others who understood, you know, that great power... Power corrupts, and what was it, infinite? Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That you're walking this tightrope in this balance with whatever power you have, and we must always be aware of it, whether it's power over our children as parents, power in the job responsibilities we have, power in leadership roles we carry, that we are wielding a power and an influence that must be handled very carefully. And the way I think that I like to think of that delicate balance of power is by considering the Akam tribe in Africa. There's an ancient tribe in Western Africa, the Akam, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right. I've only ever read about them. But their chief guy, the chief top dog, is always pictured in a statue or a representation holding something. Can you see what he's holding? And if you can't see it too well in that picture, a staff will kind of make that a little bit more obvious. In this delicate balance of power, the chief's always holding an egg. And the egg represents power, because if you grip it too tightly, you'll break it. If you hold it too loosely, it'll fall and break. There's only one way to deal with this thing, and that's to hold it just right. I mean, you just too tight, it's broken. Too loose, it falls. So you have to have this delicate, careful, balanced perspective of this that you hold in your hands and wield through your authority to know that it can be overused, it can be underused, it can be abused. You can lose it altogether or very much abuse it if you don't hold it in this delicate balance. I love that. Because it's not saying that the egg's bad. Power is okay. There's nothing wrong with power. Jesus has power. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. The Father has handed me all things. Power is not bad. It's how it's wielded and to what end. And so in our world, we're used to power that's used oftentimes for injustice and oppression and to make the rich richer and the poor poorer. We're used to that kind. So my last quote here, another Thomas Long, he says, no matter how sophisticatedly it is packaged, human authority is a matter of raw power. If you have enough people behind you or guns with you, you have it, and what you say goes, period. We see that in TV shows, you know, whoever's got the biggest gun holds the others hostage or tells them what to do. Why? If they don't do it, because they have the power. Divine authority, on the other hand, has to do with truth. And the truth of God, the truth about who God made us to be. So in the short run, human authority can appear to overwhelm divine authority, even to crucify it. But ultimately, God's truth prevails. And of course, that's what will happen by the end of our story. Human authority will crucify divine authority. And for one brief moment, it appears like human authority wins the day. But God's truth is raised from the dead to announce that when all is said and done, earthly authority has been gathered up into the divine, and Jesus will end our gospel with all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go into all the world, make disciples of all people. So the answer to who's in charge is quite simple in our story. Jesus is running the show here. They might think that they have the power, but by asking them that one question, He has shown who the master debater is, the one who is going to take charge and put people in their place, even if it's hard, because he's going to speak, as Walter Brueggemann says, truth to power. He's going to speak the truth, even if the power is going to resist it or be challenged by it. He's going to speak it because, keep in mind, the wonderful thing about our Gospels is no one gets to vote on whether Jesus is Lord. He is whether you like it or not. So our challenge is to conform ourselves to it and to seek the highest authority, which is truth, God's truth. God's truth manifest in our lives, God's truth manifested through what we do, not human power, which again and again shows its fallibilities and shows its horrible injustices and abuses. We're called to stick by the power that is the truth, that Jesus is Lord, Jesus is Messiah. He can speak wherever he wants. And if he's got a question to challenge us, we better seriously and curiously try to answer it as best as we can instead of get in a corner and say, what's the right answer that will make us all look good? We best answer honestly. Would you pray with me?